Yes, please. Yes, please. No need to stand on the floor.
Well, good evening, everyone. Let me welcome you here to the LSC for this event that's jointly organised by the Hellenic Observatory and by the Turkish Studies Programme and in cooperation with ENGI. Yeshim Harris, who is, well, one of the architects of the events that have been held here in London, is going to say a little bit at the end about her organisation and the project. But I'm here to sort of welcome you all to what I think is a very, very interesting lineup of speakers. As a number of you might be aware, that there was an event last night at the Houses of Parliament, and it produced, I think, a very interesting debate and discussion, and we're hoping to be able to take it forward this evening. Some of you were there last night, welcome back. To those of you who weren't, I think you're going to find it very, very interesting indeed to hear such a range of views. I'll introduce the speakers first, and I'll explain a little bit about how we'll do things this evening. I should apologise from the outset about the size of the room. We're right in the middle of exams at the moment, and apparently the estates don't like to free up rooms because they've got to be ready to be set up for, or they've got to be ready for the next morning. So it's a little bit of a squash. So thank you very much for putting up with it. Working, I think, from the right through to the left, I'll introduce our speakers. The first is Mihalis Avram, who's from the NGO Support Centre in Cyprus. And then we have Bulent Kanol from the Management Centre, Alexandros Lordos from Cyprus 2015, Maliha Gaimak from Edge Cyprus, then Marios Epaminondas from the Association for Historical Dialogue and Research, Rana Zincir from the UN Gender Advisory Team and the Association for Historical Dialogue and Research, and then Katerina Antoniou from Youth Power Cyprus. The way that we'll do it is each of them will basically give 3 or 4 minutes introduction on various aspects of the work that they've been doing, and then pass it on to the next person. Then at the end of it, we'll open it up to discussion from the floor. And Alexandros will go first. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming here and honoring us with your presence and your interest to hear what we have to say and to share your views with us. First of all, I would like to thank those who have made this event possible, ENGI and the UNDP Act, the Hellenic Observatory, the Contemporary Turkish Studies Program, and of course our moderator, James Kellinzi. We have come here today as representing several organizations of civil society in Cyprus. At the moment, at the juncture of the peace talks, which is, I'm sure for those of you who are following developments, how shall I call it, disappointing, dispiriting. And we have come here wanting to give you a different message, a message about how things could be done, how the process could be done better in Cyprus. Because we have done a lot of public opinion research in both communities in Cyprus, I'd just like to give you some background on how Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots feel about the Cyprus issue. In several public opinion polls, we have asked the question, do you actually want the settlement of the Cyprus problem? Do you want this peace process that is being managed by the two leaders to actually reach a successful outcome, or would you really prefer that it fails? And both communities, and to the same extent, say that they want the peace process to succeed. So something like 70% of each community say they want the success of the peace process. Then we ask them another question, though. We ask them, do you expect it to succeed? And to that question, so what is, do you think it's going in the right direction? To that question, only 15% answer positively. The remaining 80 to 85% say, no, I don't think this is going anywhere. So there's a big discrepancy between what people want, which is a settlement, and what they are getting, which is a continuing deadlock. What do people want? Do they want a federal compromise? Yes, they want a federal compromise. We have asked the question in many different ways. We have tested different possible solution models. We have asked people whether they want a unitary state or a federation or a two-state solution. And the answer is crystal clear. Greek Cypriots would ideally prefer a unitary state, but are willing to accept federation as a second best. And Turkish Cypriots would ideally want a two-state solution, but are willing to accept federation as a second best. So federation is there for both communities, not as the ideal choice, but as a tolerable compromise. And this is both a danger and an opportunity. It's a danger because it's very easy for each side to just go away and focus on what it ideally wants and cause conflict. But it's an opportunity because if the right spirit of compromise and cooperation and partnership is there, the problems can be overcome. But this is where what we want to say tonight comes in. Unfortunately, this spirit is almost non-existent in Cyprus now. The mood is very negative, both at the top level of the Track 1 negotiations and on the ground, at the grassroots of society, with ordinary citizens, political parties, civil society organizations. There is a why? Why is this so negative? Let me give you another fact from the polls. We have been asking, over the last 4 years where negotiations have been going on, we have been asking the question, what would you vote in a future referendum? If the negotiations succeeded and you were given a chance to vote at the referendum, what would you do? At the beginning, 4 years ago, it was pretty much evenly balanced. Lots of people standing on the fence, neither yes nor no, and a strong yes and a strong no contingent. As time has gone by over the last 4 years, while intensive negotiations were going on at the level of the leaders, the answer from the people has become increasingly negative. Every time we ask, more people say they would vote no, less people say they would vote yes. Even though nothing has been discussed with them, no plan has been shared with the people over the last 4 years, but the public is becoming increasingly disengaged. Why is it becoming disengaged? Because no one is consulting with the public. No one is engaging the people. And this is not new. This began back in the 1950s even, if you want to be even more historical, when the very first discussions about the future of Cyprus were taking place. It was natural back then. Democracy was not yet had not yet come to that part of the world. So it was natural that when you were discussing what the future would be, that you would consult with the big guys, yeah, on the leaders of the village that was then Cyprus. Yeah, you would speak to the 5 or 6 people who had some kind of education and that you could interact with, and you anointed them leaders of the community, and then you could negotiate with them. So it was natural back then. In 1963, when the troubles began, the UN came in and started the process of negotiating with the Greek Cypriot and the Turkish Cypriot leader. Back at the time when people respected leaders and expected leaders to solve problems. That process has remained pretty much the same until 2012. The process of the UN going into a room with two leaders and trying to work everything out. Since then, society has moved on. Democracy has flourished in the Turkish Cypriot and the Greek Cypriot community, despite problems, despite corruption, external interference, despite all the weaknesses that most modern democracies have. Yes, Cyprus has become democratic. Citizens have developed a sense of assertiveness, a sense, an expectancy that they should be involved and that they should be in the know about what is going on. And in every other aspect of their daily life, yes, there is consultation. When new laws are to be passed, all the relevant NGOs that are involved in that specific sector are invited to parliament. They say what they say their views, but not on the Cyprus problem. The Cyprus problem has stayed in a bubble, in a historical bubble, some kind of twilight zone of its own, not being influenced by history, by developments, by progress. And this process is not only disappointing to the people who are just looking, who are kind of outside looking in, but they're also extremely frustrating for the two leaders who, having no public legitimization for what they're doing, no public feedback, are left without the ground on which to stand. So positions are becoming increasingly arbitrary. Just to give you a vignette of how tired and frustrated the leaders are, recently they have started using statements with some culinary metaphors to express their frustration. So a few months ago, Dr. Eroglu said that the negotiations are like trying to eat uncooked aubergines. Yeah, so for those of you who have ever tried to eat uncooked aubergines, you can imagine how bad that is. And just last week, President Christofias said the negotiations are like trying to throw eggs against the wall. So I don't know why both of them are referring to food so much. They must have a hobby with eating like I do and some others in this room. But this is how the leaders themselves feel about the negotiations. Now, so what are we advocating here? We're advocating that civil society and society at large should be part of the process. But your criticism would be, have we just now worked this out after all this time? Haven't we thought about this before? No, we have thought about this before, and we've been trying to do this for many years now. But we have not, it's been like throwing eggs against the wall, actually. What has happened? Just to give you an example, back in 2007, after a lot of lobbying and a lot of pressure from civil society organizations and from the UN representatives in Cyprus, the two leaders submitted proposals to include the people in the talks. The Greek Cypriot side sent a proposal to put together a civil society consultative body that would include civil society organizations and representatives of the leaders working together to discuss the options and take some feedback from the people back at the negotiating table. And the Turkish Cypriot side submitted a proposal for a social reconciliation commission comprised of sociologists and psychologists that would investigate the mistrust and propose recommendations to improve the situation. You might say that both are very interesting ideas and sound very promising, and I would totally agree with you. But what was the fate of these ideas? The one leader rejected the proposal of the other. Each leader somehow found that the proposal of the other was dangerous. They had their own logic. I mean, they thought about something that it made sense to them at that time, but absolutely does not stand to daylight. And that's the problem with closed negotiations. Something they do not stand to the light of day, to the light of logic, to the light of public legitimization. So this is my own kind of introduction to the subject. I want to pass on to my friend Marios Epaminondas, who will tell you a bit more about what is the alternative paradigm that we think should be prevailing in the peace process in Cyprus.
I would like to elaborate a bit more on how the way we have learned to think about the problem and the peace process might inhibit our efforts to move forward, and how an alternative way to see this peace process can help us to move in a more productive way. As you know, in 2003, there were some openings in the checkpoints in Cyprus, so the physical contact between the people became more easy. However, there seem to exist some virtual checkpoints in a way, which are hounding our ideas of the peace process. And along with the buffer zone, which lies between the two confronting armies, there seems to be a buffer zone which divides unresolved arguments, different representations of history, and seemingly incompatible interests. So what we propose is that these buffer zones should be transformed into cooperation zones. Because if we have buffer zones which are confrontation lines, they are always likely to become a bigger problem. To those who care enough about Cyprus and who follow the peace process, probably like you, and who are tired of talking, we would like to propose a new way of thinking about the peace process inside. And in this new way of thinking, we propose to include more people and groups than just the two designated leaders and their advisors. In this new way, we will not just refer to the efforts for a compilation of a master text, i.e. the comprehensive solution of the Cyprus problem, but something else. It will be a way that we regard the peace process not as a necessary evil which take place until the compilation of this text and then becomes obsolete. Given that any peace-building effort should aim at establishing self-sustainable structures which are likely to produce positive social changes in the long run, we propose that we start seeing the peace process with this lens. And we, in this way, we can see different levels and different areas of peace processes. And these processes are the processes which our organizations are engaged already. And we have some positive message in this regard. The work that our groups are doing is producing and it's very likely to continue producing positive outcomes. And just to make a small example, my colleagues will give you more later. Right here in this room, we have a catalog of publications that our association has produced, which are dealing with the sensitive issue of history. And this was possible through dialogue and cooperation of people across the divide from different ethnic backgrounds and religious backgrounds and linguistic backgrounds, and who are working in cooperation with people from the international arena. For us, our actions like this should not be suspended until the compilation of this final text from the leaders. On the contrary, any action who will bring together people and empower them to take initiatives for common good should be planned and implemented every day. And these processes can fit into any comprehensive settlement, and at the same time, they can become the pieces of the future state of affairs, which will be based on cooperation. Activities which are likely to lead to the formation and practice of peaceful and democratic attitudes and values among citizens, including tolerance, mutual trust, non-violent conflict resolution, are to be pursued. Facilitating dialogue and interaction, especially between those likely to disagree, and establishing relationships to support collaboration between groups with common interests should be nurtured. Articulation of key issues in order to bring them to the public agenda without prejudice and without fear should be enhanced. And in general, developing a culture of peace based on dialogue and cooperation should be our permanent effort. And with this, I would like to
okay. Yes, I just want to start with thanking James for hosting us here. This is an esteemed institution to host us here, and I am really very glad to be able to address this distinguished group of guests here. Now, we are not here really to promote any kind of solution as a group, but we are here to tell you our story. And what we did towards the peace process or the reconciliation process in Cyprus. We should not give you the illusion that we are representing the civil society also. We are only just part of a civil society, because there are other groups in Cyprus which are doing similar things or maybe different things also. So we are not in that kind of ambitious position to present ourselves as representing the civil society. Having said this, I just wanted to talk to you about the bi-communal civil society movement in Cyprus, because I have been involved in this personally, involved in this for many years, and since 2000 my institution, the management center, has been involved in it also. This whole bi-communal activity started as part of the political ideological motivations of certain political parties and their associates. These were mainly leftist parties. And after a while, we are seeing some interest to these activities from some academic circles, both locally and internationally, and also some diplomatic circles. And we are seeing individual activists coming into this process, and individual intellectuals coming into this process on their personal basis. So this continued for some decades. And then when we came to 2000, we see a kind of a turning point there for this whole movement, because there were some institutions that started getting involved this whole process. And there were some resources also available from organizations like UNDP, and EU wasn't around at that time, but the UN was around all the time. So they were very much, because they have the mandate for peace, they were also very much interested in this. And they started supporting the civil society organizations to build capacity and also to be engaged in this reconciliation process. And I think this was a very important turning point for this whole movement. And since then, we can give you some examples of structures of cooperation. Because when we talk about Cyprus, we always think about these leaders coming together and, you know, defending their own positions, and most of the time cannot agree on anything. But there are a lot of work going on in Cyprus with this track two level, which is the civil society level. And there has been some structures already built there. For example, there are civil society organizations coming together and signing partnership agreements and doing a joint project together and coming out with some outcomes. I mean, our organizations are good examples of this. There are other organizations who are coming together under an international umbrella and doing work together. And recently, you might not be aware, or you are probably aware, some of you, that there are networks of civil society organizations who are working together in Cyprus. The chambers are working together, especially the chambers of commerce and industry, the chambers of engineers and architects. They are doing a lot of good work together. So these are the positive things that that are going on. And of course, there are still informal initiatives of individuals here and there which are doing quite good work in Cyprus. When we talk about peace activities, we are talking about a four-step kind of circle. There should be a need, but it should be also coupled with resources, secondly, and capacity and legitimacy. So do we have a need for the peace process in Cyprus? Yes, the polls are saying it very clearly that there is a need. Maybe people are not believing in it, but there is a need there. Is there some resources? Unfortunately, there aren't local resources so much, but international resources are there. I mentioned one, which is the UNDP, but EU is also there giving some international funding to these issues. But not just funding, but there are some technical expertise also coming from international sources and local sources. So this builds capacity of organizations, the society organizations, working in this field. However, when you come to legitimacy, this is where we are lacking. Because most of the work that has been going on between the two communities has been seen by some circles as a no-touch area, because most of the time people are afraid of being labeled as traitors, you know. So there is a need for legitimacy, and legitimacy comes from either the leadership really supporting this kind of activities, or in the absence of this recognition, the legitimacy sometimes can also come from international organizations. So this has been one instrument that we have been using. The UN has been one strong instrument that we have been using for our activities, and EU also is coming with some strong support. Don't they have their own deficiencies? Definitely, we are going to talk about that maybe later. They have their deficiencies, but they have been giving legitimacy to the whole process. We as Engage, we are trying to gain the legitimacy. When I say Engage, we are doing a project called Engage as the Management Center and NGO Support Center. We are trying to gain the legitimacy by reaching more people to the grassroots, but also reaching the key people. And there are certain mechanisms that we use for in our Engage project, which I don't have the time to go into. But as a final word, I would like to just say that it is now time that we come to a deadline with the Track 1 process. Now it is time that the civil society organizations, with all these structures and with all these success stories, although they are limited, they should be also somehow involved in the process by certain way of the leaders and the international organizations accepting them as part of the whole process in the next phase of negotiations, if there is going to be a next phase, and we think we should have a next phase.
Thank you very much. Next to speak is Katerina.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. Civil society has not only succeeded in providing a successful model of bicommunal cooperation, what is also successful within civil society is that it manages to reflect the different groups and sectors of the society. And in its diversity, civil society in many occasions can be more representative of the society than what we have seen in traditional political discourse. And one of the social groups that are being represented within civil society is the youth. And please allow me to elaborate more on the young people, my peers and younger generations that live in Cyprus, what the current challenges are, and what we seek to achieve through the change that we are suggesting. Today, the youth of Cyprus is disengaged from political discourse. In fact, many are very pessimistic. They feel no connection to political processes. And in many cases, they are not interested in getting involved in any kind of political dialogue or in any way become more active when it comes to social issues. In some cases, that's because the young people do feel comfortable within their comfort zones. In other cases, though, it's because they feel that there isn't a chance of making a difference, really, because there is this gap between the decision makers and the actual young people. This results in a norm of apathy from the young people, and what is normal to see around is that the lack of dialogue leads into a fragmentation, not only across the communities, but within the communities as well, and between the young people and other generations. Maybe one can argue that young people are simply not very interested in politics or not to their majority. But in fact, if we don't really see the prospect of making a difference, then we wouldn't really try and make the effort in doing that. What civil society has managed to change through the emergence of recent initiatives, especially within the bicommunal setting, is to actually get a lot of young people directly active within activities that relate to social issues or the political discourse. Unfortunately, today, these efforts can only go this far because civil society remains handicapped within the wider political sector. What needs to be done is to actually strengthen civil society and provide the tools for bridging the gap between the initiatives that are being done on the ground and the decision makers that are particularly in charge of the peace process in Cyprus. We are very capable of changing the norm of pessimism that is around, especially within the younger generations, by providing them the tools to discuss and to be active when it comes to actually shaping their own future. So to actually put on the ground a stronger civil society will enable to have a stronger youth, a youth that is more aware, is more politically active, is more eager to engage in social issues, and is actually more able to celebrate its diversity within the entire of Cyprus as a whole, and that would definitely lead to a stronger society. I think I would now allow Rana to continue.
Thank you all for coming and allowing us to share our work with you. It's really incredible to see the turnout tonight and to know that there's such an interest from you in our work and what we're doing and support for it. And for many of us, it's our first time presenting in London, and what you think about what we're saying is also very important to us, and we hope we can continue with this dialogue and host you in Cyprus too when you come back. I want to talk about the role of women. And I'll make three points. And the first of these follows on what Katrina has been saying and Alexandros and my other colleagues. And that has to do with the nature of our system in Cyprus. What's evident is that women are not present at the negotiating table. In the same way that many voices are left out, women's are not there either. And this is something that we see across the board with other decision-making structures in society. Although there might be women who have become ministers or who have played roles as parliamentarians, it's not so much the presence of women, it's also the extent to which there's a gender perspective that's included within these mechanisms and within the systems. Because a man can also be an advocate for gender equality in the same way that a woman. But when we look at the negotiation, not only are women not there, but it also lacks a gender perspective. And this is what we've been trying to do, is to try to introduce a wider perspective, one that ensures that the society, the systems, the settlement that eventually comes to be will be one that fosters a truly just, democratic, and equal society. So within the parameters that are being discussed, for future Cyprus, wouldn't we also want to ensure that women have a voice and have a greater role to play in public life? And I think the answer to this is yes. For this to happen, though, there needs to be, as we've been all saying, a fundamental paradigm shift within the peace process so that it can include diverse voices. And I want to get to my second point now, which is why is it important to include the voice of women and to have this gender perspective? Women experience conflicts differently. Their experience as mothers, as caretakers, or as individuals are unique. It's different. The way that they encounter their vulnerabilities are quite different within the context of conflict. And also their role, potential role as peace builders within communities is also evident. And therefore, their expectations and the demands that they have within the context of trying to build peace and trying to create solutions will also vary. However, these aren't necessarily being taken into account. And if you look at some of the polls, such as those conducted by Alexandros or other research that's done, we do find that women might be more reluctant on some issues, or they might be more proactive on other issues. And I think as almost the majority or even more than the majority of the population, this isn't something that we can simply ignore and bypass. It has to be also taken into account. And this isn't just a demand coming from Cyprus. This has been something that's been accepted by the international community. In the year 2000, all member states of the United Nations voted unanimously to support Security Council Resolution 1325. This Security Council Resolution mandates that peace processes, conflict resolution, post-conflict reconstruction includes a gender perspective and that women should be involved in these processes. This is an internationally accepted standard. But how does this get enacted? Although this resolution was passed in 2000, it's only been recently that traditional mediating mechanisms are starting to understand how to bring these different perspectives together. So, for example, in the United Nations, it's only now that for example, the UN Women is starting to have much more of an integrated perspective and operations with the mediation unit within the United Nations. It's been the case for us in Cyprus as well. We've realized that the traditional way of carrying out and the peace talks isn't quite doesn't quite know how to handle demands that are coming from women or demands that have to do with gender equality. We've developed recommendations. Our group, the Gender Advisory Team, has developed recommendations on power sharing and governance, on citizenship and property rights. And we've also tried to see how we can have a more mainstream gender perspective within the peace process. And what I want to say that's what's been unique about this is that, for example, if you think about the debates having to do with cross-voting, which has been very lively in the last few months, it tends to be, the debates tend to revolve around ethnic representation or how communities will be represented within the outcomes of cross-voting or other electoral systems. As women, or as society, wouldn't we also want to be interested in how electoral laws or party laws, how those can be adjusted to facilitate the inclusion of more women or different voices within political parties in a federal Cyprus? So what I'm trying to say is that as women, and other groups too, our concerns cut across the ethnic lines or the community lines. We think commonly as Cypriots, as women, and so the issues that we care about, they bridge the traditional way of looking at the Cyprus problem or the solutions to the Cyprus problem, and they enable us to think with one common voice and one common perspective and one common vision. For example, we care about equal representation and equal pay, domestic trafficking, domestic violence and trafficking, and these are all issues that can't wait for a solution. They're island-wide issues, and we need to work together on that, and we need to work together on them with mechanisms that can be set up now, and that can be enacted now. So for this to happen, though, there needs to be this radical shift in the way that we think about building coalitions and thinking in common about solutions and processes. So I'll turn it over to Meliha now to address her vision.
Thank you for coming and for listening to us and also providing us with feedback. We're all looking forward to it. I'd like to give you a perspective from a business person's view. And I will focus on three things. Number one, it would be how the business people in both communities in Cyprus are feeling right now and the level of trade between the two communities. Number two, how business people can be included in the peace negotiation process. And number three, specific example of how such inclusion would actually help towards a solution. So my first point is how the business people are feeling right now in Cyprus. Well, unfortunately, both Turkish Cypriot and Greek Cypriot business people feel totally jaded and disenchanted with these negotiations and the peace process. They're not looking forward to, they're actually looking at life as usual, business as usual, and a solution or the negotiations are distant to them and peripheral to their daily business. They are reactive to whatever is going on between the two leaders instead of a possible solution, instead of being proactive and strategic thinking, which was the way they were around 2004 and right after 2004. As you know, due to the economic crisis, but also because of the current stagnation that we felt in Cyprus of the negotiations and the peace talks, both communities are feeling, the business people in both communities are feeling the pressure, and they're in survival mode. They are having to do with what they have. There are some business relationships that exist between the two communities. There is some trade going on, and some of these business relationships are quite solid. I'd like to give you some statistics without boring you with regards to the green line trade, which is the trade from the north to the south, and the mirror trade from the south to the north. As you know, the green line trade came into effect around 8 years ago, and so far, although there have been several initiatives and efforts by all three chambers that exist on the island, which is KEVE, Cyprus Chamber of Industry and Commerce, KTTO, which is the Cyprus-Turkish Chamber of Commerce, and CTCI, which is the Chamber of Cyprus-Turkish Chamber of Industry. There's been several efforts by them, as well as the EDGE program, which is where I work, to bring together traders and interested parties to do business between the two communities. The number of trade and the number of traders are only a handful. It's the same people trading, unfortunately, a limited amount of goods. The level of trade, you would think that the level of trade between the two closest neighbor economies would be the highest percentage of their entire trade with the rest of the world. Well, unfortunately, the percentage of trade that exists over the buffer zone has never reached above 0.1% of the total trade with the rest of the world for each of the two communities. Why? You want to ask why this has happened? Well, because there are political circumstances that is preventing the traders and the number of goods to be traded. And the most important thing is that neither of the leaders, who are the main bodies in the negotiating table, have embraced or openly encouraged trade between the two communities. Over the last 5 years, when the green line trade first started, there was some increase, like drastic increases over the first couple of years. But over the last 5 years, this trade has stagnated. And if we put it in numbers, the trade from north to the south, meaning the goods that are sold from north to the south, has been around 5 to 5.5 million per year. And in the other direction, from south to north, the sale of goods totals around 1 million to 1.5 million euros per year. This is the recorded trade. At the same time, though, there is another trade going on that's unrecorded, and also the third type, which is the personal spending of individuals in both communities. In 2001, 12.6 million euros were spent by Turkish Cypriots in the south, and and 7.1 million, which is less than half of the Turkish Cypriots' share, 7.1 million euros were spent by Greek Cypriots in the north or in Turkey. So there is definitely a capacity for further trade to take place, but unfortunately it hasn't taken place. So this is the way that the business people feel and have been trading amongst themselves in the two communities. Now, my second point is, how can the business society be included in the peace negotiations? Well, you've all known that, you all hear about it when any two countries get together for trade agreements. The leaders bring with themselves some business leaders from chambers or business people for consultation, because this is their specialty, right? Because no political leader is expected to be equipped with, you know, business skills, political skills, and, you know, women issues or youth issues. So they bring consultants. Well, what happens in Cyprus is that the two leaders sit around the table, and when issues of economics, finance, and trade come up, they don't consult with anybody on that subject, just like they don't consult with anybody on any other subject. They just start yelling at each other and go into a blame game. So what we're suggesting is that going forward, the business people and the leaders from both communities on the subjects of business can be included as consultants in subject matters that involve them and is important to them. This also would encourage the leaders to talk on based on statistics and specific data, and put educated and knowledgeable arguments instead of what is being done right now, which is talking on anecdote rather than actual data. And I'd like to put forward my third point, which is the specific example of how the collaboration between the business leaders and the chamber presidents over the last 6 years helped resolve a certain problem that happened in the island in the last year. As Edge Project, our main aim is to, our main objective is to increase the competitiveness of the Turkish Cypriot economy and entrepreneurs, as well as the business chambers, so that they are brought up and hopefully be in par, to be in par with the Greek Cypriot economy and the business leaders, should there be a solution. So since 2006, the EDGE program has been holding what is now known as the Commerce Roundtables, where every month or every 3 months, the business leaders and the chamber presidents from both communities are brought together and to discuss certain problems or issues with regards to the Greenland trade. Initially, this was, by the way, the first time that the business, the chamber leaders came together specifically for a purpose on a regular basis. In the first couple of years, they used this forum to facilitate, to resolve some of the barriers to Green Line trade. But over time, they passed it on to, they passed this job onto their technocrats, and which actually resolved with an online tool that works pretty efficiently. So what's remaining for the business, the chamber presidents, is to find new ways of new ways of expanding the Green Line trade and finding new ways of cooperation. However, we keep, and they keep hitting a brick wall because of the political situation. But last year, their hard work and collaboration started giving fruit. We all know, as you probably heard too, July 2011 was a turning point where one of the electrical plants in the Greek Cypriot community has stopped working for some reasons that we don't care to discuss here. And the Greek Cypriot community was in great need for extra energy, electrical energy. It was the presidents of the two chambers that got together and resolved this problem. They called each other, they put themselves forward, discussed, negotiated, and found a way to resolve this problem for the Greek Cypriot community. So this shows that business leaders and business people are looking at how to make gains from a situation rather than looking and focusing on the cost. So if we include business people in the negotiations as consultants, you would, we would be increasing the hope factor because they would be focusing on the gains, which there will be ton, a lot of it, and to offset the possible cost of a solution, which we don't disagree that there would be. I don't want to keep any more take any more time, and I'd like to pass it on to Mihaly Savram for a roundup.
Yes, thank you. Well, I have the difficult task of summarizing everything of what my colleagues have said, and thank you for coming this evening. I'm impressed by the number of people who are keep interested in on Cyprus, and we hope to increase the numbers and try and bring change. Our vision is for a more inclusive and transparent peace process, and civil society demands to be included in the process. To give you an example of the deficiency of the whole process as it's been going on for the last 2 years, and not actually 2-3 years, for some decades now, the basis of a solution has been agreed and always been said that this will be based on a bi-zonal, bi-continental federation. This has never been explained. I mean, until now, you don't have a clear understanding of what it's meant by bi-zonal, bi-communal federation. Even political parties among themselves cannot agree on what they mean on this terminology. This is not a phrase which has no content, it has no explanation. It's not something that is going to be reinvented just in the case for Cyprus. It exists in other states. It will have to be adjusted for the specific situation of Cyprus, but this is something that the leaders have always agreed on. And there was even in the 8th of July agreement between President Papadopoulos and Talat. This was reinstated again in the talks between Eroglu and Christofias, that the solution would be based on a bizonal, bicommunal federation. Has there any efforts been taken by anyone to explain to people what we mean by bizonal, bicommunal federation? This is one of the weaknesses of the whole process, and it shows the non-inclusiveness of civil society and the ordinary citizen in the streets. We believe that there should be a parallel and simultaneous focus on reaching a settlement and in enhancing daily cooperation between the communities. Each of these processes can only become viable in the presence of the other. Leaders and citizens have a key role to play in both of these processes. We are not trying to replace the politicians and the political leadership. We are trying to contribute towards reaching a solution, supporting all the efforts that they are making to promote the solution and to ensure that any solution that is reached is sustainable and will last in time. If you don't build bridges of communication, if you don't explain to people what all this is all about, how would you expect them to wake up on a morning and hear on the radio that the solution has been reached and they will go out in the streets in support of such a solution? If they don't feel that they are part of the process, if they don't feel that they have not been heard, their needs, their concerns have not been taken on the negotiation table and have not been discussed openly and answers given, how would you expect people to stand up and support the solution exactly? This is why it's important to have the citizens engaged in the process. This is what we have been trying to do over the last 20 years. We have been trying to keep channels of communication open. We have been trying to hear the other side, to hear the other argument. This is what we've been trying to do. We don't agree with all we have to say, but we find ways to overcome our differences. We find constructive ways that end up with having us to reach not on situations of give and take, but on win-win, which is what we all want. The other big problem that we are facing at the moment is the fact that the hope factor is zero in Cyprus at the moment. If you ask a citizen in the street, do you feel we're going to get a solution? Everybody says no. And why should I be engaged in the process when I don't see that I can make a change? Why would I have a part in to play in this process if I don't see hope? And we are desperately in need of increasing public interest and engaging the people in the peace process. Again, this will only come about if you start discussing the issues in the open. If you start engaging the people, we'll probably need a shock factor, and hopefully that could be a shock factor. In our views, maybe the opening of Varosha could be a shock factor that will make us look at the problem from a constructive point of view and a creative way to rebuild our economy, which is in a mess, to allow the people to reconstruct their properties and to create hope that soon we will get into a new momentum of reaching a comprehensive solution in Cyprus. Instead of being closed, the negotiation should be an open and transparent process, allowing reporting on the discussions in real time. This will prevent the twisting of the messages. It would increase trust and decrease the speculation of the talks. We have here also another big problem. Because there has no flow of information from the negotiation stage between the two leaders, there is reporting which is not that accurate most of the time. We don't hear of any progress. We only hear about deadlocks. How can you increase the hope of people for a solution if all you hear is that there's all negative, there is no progress on any issue. Nothing positive ever gets discussed in the open. We should enhance the daily collaboration at every level, and it should be strongly supported by the leadership. We always include the leadership in all our demands. We feel they have a very important role to play, and unfortunately, we are lacking leadership in both communities, and we want leadership. We want leadership that will involve the people, will create the momentum, and we will push the process forward, and we get us out of the box. We are in a box, and we have been in a box for so many years, not allowing us to look outside the box. As I mentioned before, the emphasis should not be on give and take, but on win-win. The current status quo is not static, but very dynamic, and a potential conflict in waiting. We have this understanding and feeling in Cyprus that, you know, there's no violence. You know, we all lead our lives. We don't have any problems. We go to work. We have families are fine. We send our kids. It's a normal situation. You know, there's no problem in Cyprus. I mean, that's what people are giving the impression. And especially when you hear others say, but do you have a problem in Cyprus? We don't feel that you have a problem in Cyprus. Of course we have a problem in Cyprus. The status quo is not static. There are things that are changing daily. There are things on the ground that are affecting the future solution negatively. The longer it takes, the more difficult it gets. And we need to make sure that we understand this. There is also now the added potential, and let's hope that we will be able to develop this into a nice and creative way to both all of us sort of with the solution benefit also with the exploration of the natural gas and be able to have a new dimension to our economic prosperity on the island. So to achieve all these aims, structural reform of the peace process is needed. In order to allow harmonious collaboration of track one, the leaders, track two, civil society, and track three, the wider public and the business community, at the level of the leader, liaisons will have to be appointed, whose sole task will be to interface with key members of civil society, and NGOs should be allowed and given the information to go out to their constituencies and members and explain what is happening at the political process. How your contribution will be very much appreciated, and we are really hoping for your contribution and your support. Academics and researchers, much of the research has been conducted in the field of the horizontal gap between ethnic groups. We need to look also at the gap between citizens and leaderships. The economic benefits of resolving the conflict should also be researched in the case of Cyprus, and the findings publicly discussed. This is even more important now with the discovery of the natural gas in the region. Students have a responsibility to play. Students are the future of our country, and they should try and engage in the process. They are the most to benefit out of a solution. They should open channels of communication and dialogue. They should help build a sustainable future. To London-based Cypriots, I mean, all these issues need to be taken by every Cypriot. And these will need to be discussed also in diaspora organizations. There is a need to be lobbying from all over the world, the politicians and officials and influential players who are affecting the progress in the peace talks. And this will be very much appreciated and will have a very big impact if it's done at all centers of potential influential countries. For example, the UK, the diaspora here can lobby the UK government. The Cypriots in America can lobby the American government for promoting and pushing for a more inclusive peace process and pushing for a solution. We want the diaspora to engage in promoting the solution of Cyprus. So the existence of the problem is holding our country back and makes our lives very difficult. We can only achieve sustainable economic development when we stop to be a hostage of our political problem. We are very much aware of our past, but we need to build a future. And with this note, I would like to thank you once again for coming, and I will open the floor for any, going back to the coordinator James for opening up the floor.
Thank you very much, Michalis. we have now about 20-25 minutes for question. I'm going to very obviously abuse chair's privilege here to ask two opening questions and then sort of put it out to the floor. And I think one of the things that came out from yesterday's discussion, but time and time again whenever Cyprus is discussed, is the role of history. And the two communities have very, very different interpretations. So I'd rather like to ask Rana and Marios to talk a little bit about the work that you're doing on this and the ways that you're challenging this. And the second question, I think, sort of touches on what Mihalis said, but if any other member of the panel would have something to say on this, which is, I think it's tremendously important for political leaders to communicate what they're doing in a broad sense in any peace negotiation. The danger, of course, is that if you open it up and you start discussing specifics, then people start to reject them. No, we can't. And you need to see it very much as part of an overall package. And how do you think you can sort of reach that balance in Cyprus, where you do have politicians speaking to the population and explaining? Because you're right, nobody's ever told anyone what a bizonal bicommunal federation means. And it does mean very different things to the two communities, and there needs to be debate on this. But going into details about, you know, what presidential system is going to exist, I think can be very problematic. So I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say on that.
About history teaching. Our association has the mission to promote historical understanding among the public and create a forum for a productive dialogue on issues of history, historiography, and history teaching. And one basic question we have to ask ourselves when we are dealing with these issues is why should we bother about history, or why should we teach history to the younger generation? And according to the answer that we will give to this question, we will develop a system of teaching and learning history in our societies. And for many years, our society, taking example from other societies in Europe and in the Western world, they have been focusing on what was a nation-centered history, and which had the main aim to advocate for a certain position of what we call our in-group, of our group. And this way of teaching and learning history have certain consequences in a way. And one of the consequences is that students and citizens, usually, they are keen on learning a specific narrative by heart, usually, and forgetting it very soon afterwards. And they are more, in a way, inclined to have certain beliefs and certain stereotypes against other groups. So what we propose is that we should try and encourage the enhancement of the historical understanding among the students and the public. And what does this mean? It means that students have to come into a position to set their own questions about historical events or historical issues, and be in position to select information from different sources without prejudice, be in position to evaluate these sources and reaching to their own conclusions. And of course, somebody might say that this is good theoretically, but it's difficult in practice. It is indeed difficult. And I dare to say that it's more difficult to teach history in this way than in the traditional way. Because in the traditional way, you have easy answers for all the questions. But these answers are not answers which create citizens which are active learners. And in the association, and Anna can tell you more about it, we have taken this big burden to work in this way. To our association includes people from different ethnic and national backgrounds. We are Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots, but we are not only this. We include people from other backgrounds. We also cooperate with advisors, professors, historians from the from other countries, and we try to develop alternative educational materials, and we try to also provide opportunities for our educators to investigate new ways of teaching history. Usually when we talk about history teaching, our mind goes to the history textbook. The history textbook tool, and the tool can be used in different ways. It's like the knife, and you know these metaphors. You can use a knife to cut, you can use a knife to kill, but the history textbook is just a tool. And what we consider very important is to have educators which are able to use different material, including traditional textbooks, in a way that will help the students develop their own understanding and become critical and autonomous thinkers. And in following these principles, and I'm closing before I give the chance to Ranan to continue. Following this principle, we have managed to work with hundreds of educators across the divide and also to produce some educational material which are not Zimbabwe. They are tools that can be used by educators to teach different subjects of Cypriot history.
I think I'll just add just a few more thoughts here, which is a lot of comments that we receive have to do with, you know, are you trying to write one common history for Cyprus? Or you hear people saying, well, the Cyprus problem is like this because of such and such event that such and such person did, or this group is responsible for that. So clearly, history is important. You can't deny that somehow this needs to be tackled. But it has to be tackled with in a certain process, with a certain theoretical framework, and with dialogue and access to information from different perspectives. And this is what we're trying to do. We're not trying to create a united perspective. We're trying to give people the opportunity and the resources to be able to ask the right questions, to access sources, and to come to develop refined arguments, and to have discussions and a dialogue, and maybe not even settle some of these important historical questions, but maybe allow some of them to remain open. And I think the issue here is to have a genuine and open-ended, be ready to engage in open-ended dialogue. Because as we've seen in other countries in Europe, history is very complicated. And there's a certain complexity here that we all have to learn to navigate together. And this is what we're trying to facilitate for teachers, for students, by bringing together an archive in our center in the Home for Cooperation in the Buffer Zone that will allow people to understand more and to use the material there to develop new perspectives.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, your question was that how would a politician would openly discuss the fine details of the negotiation process in public? I mean, obviously, you can't expect that to happen. But if you see that there is something wrong with the process itself that is leading you nowhere, you cannot keep quiet and not say where you feel the process is going wrong. And in our case, the process has been going wrong just because this process has been only between two people closed up in a room with two UN representatives. There has been no feedback coming down, neither to political parties, not to civil society. If you are not testing what you are discussing, if you are not getting the feeling of your communities, how would you carry on these once you reach an agreement? How will you be able to take this in front of them and expect for their yes vote to accept what you have negotiated? And unfortunately, that is what we are emphasizing. We are not saying that we're here to replace politicians, or we want to hear every single nitty-gritty coming out in the open. But the process should be transparent, not the fine details of the process. The process itself should be transparent. And when it comes to issues like bi-zonal, bi-communal federation, which is supposed to have been decided and agreed by all political leaders over the, and there's UN resolutions on this. I mean, the UN resolutions specifically state that the solution in Cyprus will be a bi-zonal, bi-communal federation. no effort has been made, neither by the UN, neither by our leaders in the two communities, by nobody to explain to people what do they mean about this. And this is wrong. People should know. They should hear the different views, even if people have a different understanding of what a bizonal, bicommunal federation is. They should be allowed to sit in an audience and hear what this is all about and make their own mind and compare it with systems that already exist in other countries.
Thank you. Just
one thing to add here. The issue of package versus detail. Theoretically, it sounds logical to say, well, let the people assess the package, which will be more balanced. However, that's not the way the human mind works. The human mind is not a perfect balancing machine where you put a fear on one side and a hope on the other, and the two balance out. Fears are privileged in the human mind because we are built up to survive. So you cannot balance a danger with a hope and say, okay, this is more or less okay because it might be somewhat dangerous, but there are also some inspiring stuff as well. No, people will focus on the danger, and that's human. So we cannot just follow the package approach and say, it's okay, let's wait until we give them to them as a package and then they will assess it globally. What they will do is that they will focus on the bad parts. And so we need to be discussing this, getting feedback early on, so that we smooth out these rough edges. We don't want any part of the plan. Yes, there will of course be some compromises, but no part of the plan should be perceived as dangerous or threatening by a large segment of the community. And for that, we need to look a bit at the details as well when we then present them to people.
Well, we are going to be running out of time soon, so what I'll do is I'll take a couple of questions and a go. Gentlemen here, if you could please identify yourselves, and the point I'd really like to make is, please no speeches, just rather quick questions if we could. Thank you.
Bernard Casey from Warwick University and LSE for the Conservatory. We talked about track one and track two, but I'm also a bit interested in track three, which is these interchanges at a sort of public level, because this is the sort of thing which I see when I am in Cyprus. So we have shoppers moving in two directions. We have workers primarily moving in one direction, but there seems to be this awful lot of exchange that is going on there. I'm not sure how profound that is changing. Is this merely kind of economic transactions, very temporary economic transactions, or is it more? And it is something, is it possible that something will grow out of this? Because it seems to me this is as important as anything which is going on at an organised level.
Thank you. Lady Daff.
Lucia Vasileu, I work here at the European Institute. I've got a couple of questions for all of you. Do you have any ideas or thoughts of how you can get the London-based community, Cypriot community, involved in your activities, both Greek-speaking and Turkish-speaking, and not just talking about high-level lobbying, I'm talking about grassroots level, especially among children and the youth. Maybe Katerina may have some ideas about this. And my second question is for Alexandros.
Yeah.
I was just wondering why Cyprus 2015, what will happen in 2015? Thank you.
And
it's a crystal ball. I'll
take one more question from over in the corner.
Thank you. Yeah, Ranos Papadopoulos from the Center for Trauma Asylum and Refugees in the University of Essex. When we've been talking about the Cyprus problem, everybody's thinking about Greek and Turkish Cypriots. And that's true and that's appropriate. The reality is, in Cyprus now, there are many other people. And if we're thinking about the future, quite soon, I don't have any statistics, and I don't know if there is any institute that is working on that, but there are a lot of other people in Cyprus now, and within 20, 50 years, the demography of Cyprus is going to change drastically. And the Greeks and Turks are still not talking about Greeks and Turks. The Sri Lankans, the Eastern Europeans, so many new people are in Cyprus now, I don't want to go through, both in the north and in the south. Has any of you taken that factor into consideration? Do you know whether the existing political parties are taking that fact into consideration? Do you know whether that is at all part of the talks? Thank you.
what I'm going to do in actual fact is just take three more questions and then let everyone respond in time. So I'll take the gentleman there first. Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Chetan Ramadan. I'm from the British Turkish Cypriot Association. We're not going to talk history tonight.
Thank you.
Tonight, but welcome to the panel. We welcome any proactive confidence building measures between the two communities, especially at NGO level. We support you fully as a UK NGO as well. But I think the question is, I think we've got the order wrong in terms of what we're doing here. And just as a civil society does shape and reflect democracy in any modern country, but as a prerequisite to full interaction in a civil society, we need to fulfil the political aspirations of the communities, otherwise it will fail.
Thank you very much. Leave you there. Thank you.
Mary Christopher, I'm a student here at the LC. I was wondering what is the opinion of the speakers in the existence of a truth commission in Cyprus, or whether it will bring reconciliation between the two communities, or it will exacerbate past divisions.
And gentleman there.
Hasan Korosoy, Turkish Engineers Association. Would panel agree with me that when we go to any negotiations, there is a possibility reaching an agreement, but there is also, we have to accept that there is a possibility that we may not reach an agreement. And I think in this case, would you not agree that we did not reach agreement? Obviously that we have to try our best, and I think Turkish side tried 50 years, next year will be 50 years since 1963, that they are trying one way or the other to reach an agreement. And Turkish Cypriot, North Cyprus, they cannot make forward plans because they don't know how the future is going to hold up. Now, they've been 50 years going on. Would the panel agree with me that they have to come to the conclusion that no agreement has been reached, especially after the Annan plan when Greek side said no?
Thank you very much. Final one. Yes, if you could keep it very, very quick. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, both last night and this evening, I feel that there's a great big elephant in the room that nobody is prepared to acknowledge and accept, and that is Turkey.
Yeah.
We have got to accept that there are not two people negotiating here, but a third power behind them. Greece does not want to know anything about the Greek Cypriots. They've made that very clear a long time ago. So the Greek Cypriots are free to negotiate for themselves, but they're not negotiating with the Turkish Cypriots, unfortunately. And certainly the feeling in the Greek community is that should the Turkish Cypriots be allowed to negotiate for themselves, then we would find a solution very, very much quicker. Last night we had the example of our Irish friend who said, you know, the two, when they came out of the shadow, blah, blah. But the situation there, for those who followed the Irish situation, as Heidi from our student days, it wasn't until the United States said both to Britain and to Ireland, keep off, let them talk to each other. Do they think that there is any way by which any power can actually get Turkey to pull back and allow the Turkish Cypriots to negotiate freely with the Greek Cypriots?
Thank you very much. A lot of questions, so really what I'll do is I'll just work down, and if people could sort of pick and choose which they think is most relevant to them. So, Mihalis, do you want to start?
I'll try and address the question that was put forward by a friend, the engineer. And I would try and answer it by asking a question. I mean, as an engineer, when you're building a bridge and suddenly you reach difficulties, do you abandon the building of the bridge? Or do you become more persistent in trying to get the job done? In our case, our vision is a united Cyprus, and we're committed to this, and we will keep working for this. Despite the difficulties, despite the time it's going to take, That's why we're involved in this. That's why we have been working in this for the last 20 years, and that's why we will continue to work and hopefully be sort of the lucky ones to see a solution in Cyprus for the future, not of us, but for the future of our kids and the younger generation. And, you know, I mean, it's difficult, it's easy to give up, but we shouldn't. We have a vision, and the vision is a united Cyprus, and that's what we're working for.
Yes, maybe adding on to that, I definitely understand why that question was, because coming from the Turkish Cypriot community, I understand that the Turkish Cypriot community has this uncomfort that they have been staying in a limbo as far as the negotiations are continuing. This is the argument which is going on, and I understand this fully. The answer is, for one side, is the solution, when you ask people, they will say that, well, let's get rid of the Turkey, let's get rid of Turkey, the army, settlers, and we have a solution. For the other side, they might just say that, well, two independent states, both recognize this is the solution. I think these are the two extreme views, which is very, very difficult to reach. Very difficult to reach, almost impossible. So if we start negotiating on this level, it will be very, very difficult. So what we are really trying to say here is that we have to build a new future. And that building a new future, every federation, the academics say, every federation is unique for itself. So it has to be built by the people themselves. So you might have a federation in Cyprus which is more like a confederation or which is more like a unitary state. But it is up to the, if you don't involve the people to listen to them, what kind of a federation they really want, then you are going to have, you are going to fall into a lot of traps. We are having leaders who are going to very critical meetings and say, look, we are going to this meeting, but don't worry, we are not going to have a solution. This is the type of leaders that we have. Don't worry, we are going to a meeting, but we are not going to reach a solution. Why are they saying this? Because they know that people don't know what is going to come out of these meetings. If the people are more involved, and if the people are more informed about what they talk about, and then they will be much more comfortable when they are going to a meeting, they will say to the people, look guys, we have been talking about this type of a solution, I am going there to reach this solution. This is the type of leadership that we want to see, rather than people going to a meeting saying that, don't worry, we are not going to have a solution. What kind of a leadership is this?
Okay, I'll very quickly answer some of the questions that were posed. Is the contact that we have seen since the checkpoints opened profound or superficial? Well, both, actually. It has been superficial for the majority, as in simple everyday contact, which, however, is also helpful because it normalizes coexistence. But it has been much more in-depth and profound for a segment of the population. For instance, myself, I've been running what more or less amounts to a joint venture with Turkish Cypriot partners for the last 3 years. And we don't see each other as Greek Cypriot or Turkish Cypriot anymore. We see each other more as for our role that we have in the work that we are doing. And there are many, many examples that are like us. And this is possible because of the fact that contact is possible. Now, that's to the first question. Truth Commission. Okay. Polls show that it's controversial. Some people want it, some people oppose it, unlike a social reconciliation commission, which would be future-oriented, which everybody wants. So there is that issue of it being controversial. Personally, I think we have a need for accountability in Cyprus. People need to start understanding that when they do something wrong, they will be held accountable for it. Not necessarily go to prison or whatever, but someone has to say that what you did was wrong. And we see this lack of accountability corrupting society, not just on the issue of the Cyprus problem, but more generally. Turkey, the elephant is most definitely acknowledged. Okay, there's no question about that. And speaking personally, as a Greek Cypriot, I have personally been to Turkey on more than 5 or 10 occasions to lobby Turkish think tanks and politicians and other decision makers in Turkey to get some things moving. But the fact that someone else also has to do something doesn't absolve us of our own responsibilities to do our part as well. And the fact that Turkey has a role doesn't mean that civil society shouldn't have a role, or that Cypriot citizens shouldn't take responsibility that is their due. Until we reach a point where Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots have managed to see eye to eye, it will be extremely easy for any external detractor to find a way to upset the balances in Cyprus. So we need to develop resilience against external actors by building closer ties. And we also need to work at other levels, of course. There is a geopolitical dimension of the Cyprus problem, but it was not really the subject this evening. Other people in Cyprus, not just Greek Cypriots, are they part of the talks? No, they're not part of the talks. The fact that they don't vote means that everyone can easily ignore them when it comes to the negotiations. We do have a broader problem of an absence of a multicultural mindset in Cyprus. And we have found in our studies that this is linked to likelihood of a negative vote in a future referendum. So I think this is something that we need to work at in both communities more broadly to develop more acceptance of multiple communities. Now, both communities appear somewhat xenophobic in our polls. And finally, why Cyprus 2015? We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what will happen in 2015. But when we chose that name, which was a couple of years ago, we wanted to offer a medium-term perspective for Cyprus. Neither too long that it would be wishful thinking, nor what's going to happen next year, which means lack of planning. We think that setting a five-year horizon, a five-year plan, is a good time frame to say, look, I have these things I want to achieve, I'm going to plan for them, I'm going to implement them thoroughly, and I will hope for results. And of course, Cyprus 2015 means that our website is easy to remember, cyprus2015.org, and that's where you can download all the polls, by the way. Huh? So all of the polls are available online on our website, cyprus2015.org, so any of you who want to research the issue further, you can find all the material.
It's at least one Cyprus question solved.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and try to answer the first question, which was posed by the gentleman here, which, if I remember correctly, is there potential for trade
there's potential simply from exchange, the fact that people are interacting.
Yes.
Even at a sort of very brief basis.
There is a lot of benefit from it, for sure. Because it just shows you the numbers talk on their own. 18.6 million plus 5.5 million plus 1.6 million plus 12.6 million, 9.7 million. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of exchange. And with that, inevitably comes the interaction between people. So, and I don't want to stop it there. I think there is a very good report that looks at the benefit of a solution rather than the cost of a solution. And when you think from a business perspective, business people are always out to make a profit, and they do cost-benefit analysis. And who is there to say that the cost of a solution would be more than the benefits of a solution? You have Varosha to develop. You have several other parts of Cyprus as a united island to develop. You will get rid of many risk factors which are keeping some of the investments out. And definitely you will have a much stronger united economy than a two divided economy. And the second answer, I don't know if that answers some of your questions, but the second thing that I want to address is the engineering gentleman's argument. We are here not to propose a prescriptive solution to the Cyprus problem. We think that the process failed, the peace process failed, we don't believe that there is no solution. We think that the process is wrong. So we're here to present an alternative process or a more inclusive process. And it's for the NGOs at the Track 3 and the society at Track 4, the political parties at 2 and the leaders, all four, to be able to communicate and find the right solution. So it's for all of us to contribute. And the diaspora in the United Kingdom, as well as in other countries, play a tremendous role in that.
I don't know if I will answer any question. I will just make a statement, which I think makes sense. That is that sometimes, I mean, we have learned to see the two sides in Cyprus as two antagonistic, let's say, powers and two antagonistic positions which more probably don't have any common ground. But what we try to do, and I think it's quite effective, is that when we try to make a statement in our in the areas that we work, we try to make a statement that is, let's say, commonly endorsed by either our associations or all the individuals which come from both communities in Cyprus. And these messages, they have a certain power. And I don't know if these messages can be a determinant, let's say, force for a complete change. But I think these messages are much stronger than the messages that come from one community or another. And I also refer to the issue of Turkey. And I mean, what is Turkey? Turkey is not just one thing. In the area that we work, we have cooperation with associations from Turkey. And we believe that by having these relationships, we help the Turkish people in a way to understand the perspective of Cypriot people from both communities. Because it's not just going there and claiming, let's say, the right of one community or the other. It's having a message that is bringing the people of Cyprus together in this, let's say, this demand or this suggestion, this proposal.
This issue of the contacts, absolutely. There are all sorts of interactions that are happening in Cyprus. And this is where actually the polls don't tell the full story and don't tell the most recent stories. It's generally thought that people don't like to cross, or they like to cross once, or they cross for particular reasons. But what I've seen over the last year is that there's a lot that's happening below the surface. And I'll give an example from just a few weeks ago when a radio station in the south made a call and said, there's going to be a tour on Saturday to the northern part of Nicosia. And it was led by a famous Greek Cypriot archaeologist. And do you know how many people lined up to cross that extremely narrow and frustrating section of Vitra Street? 700 people on a Saturday. Just imagine what it means if these kinds of contacts can be facilitated and supported from mainstream, not just our organizations, but if it comes from political leaders. And I think that there's something quite special there, and our disappointment with a flawed peace process is overshadowing the potential of these human contacts. So I think that this is something really important that we need to look at and that we need to call more for. The issue of the diaspora and what more can be done here, please share with us your ideas. We don't know the context here as well as you do, so we don't come with any ready plans, but we're open to listening to what you can suggest to us. So please stay in touch with us or with our colleagues here. And I think Yeshim will say something about that. And I think I'll just mention something about the Truth Commission. I mean, I've looked at this myself, and I think it's very difficult. I think that there have been some promising examples of Truth Commissions, but I also have a fear, and I think it's based on the experiences in other contexts as well, that Truth Commissions are essentially political institutions. And they involve compromise. And what we're trying to do, the aim here is to try to have a kind of a reckoning with the past and to come to terms with what happened in the past. So maybe we need to think about different mechanisms or different processes and not just fit that large mandate within a Truth Commission, which might have a limited mandate and might actually disappoint us in what it can offer. So there's a lot of different things that can happen
and some of which we've started to do, and which historians can do by working together. You can build up archives, you can write new material, you can have people coming together, and there's a bi-communal initiative that brings together families of missing persons. I think it's just proliferation of these kinds of initiatives and the support for them, rather than being afraid of facing the history and using it as a way to blame people, is to find a way to have this honest dialogue about it. So that would be my response to that. But I think we do need to look at the past and find multiple ways of addressing it.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to repeat what has already been said. So I will try to focus on the question for the youth. Of course, the answer is yes, there is a lot of ground for including the youth in the UK, in Cyprus, and in other countries, not only Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots, but any other youth that is interested in coming along and promoting this message that we have of unity on the civil society level. Youth Power is actually a network, a bi-communal network of youth organizations in Cyprus, and we have established different regional partnerships as well. What we do on a first level is we put together events to provide ground for continuous bi-communal interaction to provide the basis for continuous dialogue between the young people on the island. So we do that through camps and through festivals and through sports tournaments or dances, or we've been going to having specific workshops and trainings, and we have put together a group of youth leaders that have been trained to engage in cross-cultural dialogue and to be facilitators and have been empowered to engage in addressing social issues. Some of the methodologies that we've been utilizing are engaging in active learning and social dialogue, and also there's a new methodology that we will be adopting in future events and activities that we will be having, which is the social innovation methodology, and which is enabling a group of to define a social group to define an issue and address it with a specific action plan and provide the facilitation and the expertise in assisting that. We have also we will also be offering entrepreneurship workshops to young people to further empower them to provide skills development. So there is definitely a variety of things that we do, of course, always in the bi-communal context, not only to allow the youth to interact with one another, but also to empower them individually and have a young generation of optimistic and active citizens. So although we do have a lot of ambassadors for our message within Cyprus, we would definitely like to engage youth within the UK, either within universities, within schools, or to have young people interested in our cause to become ambassadors of this message within exchange programs in different countries, in their interaction with youth that is not necessarily aware of the situation in Cyprus and of the prospects of reaching peace in Cyprus. So there's definitely a lot of ground for the younger generation to be active in a variety of ways. And actually, I would like to invite Yeshin to provide some more concrete suggestions of how the diaspora could be involved.
Okay, well, I will not be, this is not a speech. I have got one thing to say. One answer to a question and a question to ask you. So I've got three things. My name is Yeshin Harris. I'm the director of an organization called ENGI. We believe in peacebuilding in a very inclusive sense. So leaders, political parties, political party members, grassroots civil society, diaspora, it's all a part of peacebuilding. So we've been already working in Cyprus. We brought the two sides together, political parties and others, and now we want to continue this work. So, first of all, most importantly, first of all, thank you for coming here. It's really really a pleasure actually to have you here, and I have a suggestion to for you in a minute. But of course, the speakers here, really thank you very much for coming, and the Hellenic Observatory and Contemporary Turkish Studies, and James, thank you very much for facilitating this. Now, the answer to a question about diaspora and the local communities here, there is a suggestion that my colleague Renos Papadopoulos and myself would like to test the water if there is any room for such communication. I think there is, and so the answer is, I don't know how much has been done before, but we would definitely like to test this. And my question to you is this. There's been some sheets on that we were asking for email addresses. We will send you an email to ask your opinions, and if you would like to come with ideas. Whatever we do has to come from you. It should respond to what the needs of the communities are. If you don't like us, you can put us in the spam box, or you can say unsubscribe. We will contact you. Or alternatively, I'm here for a bit. It's a very hot room. We're here for a while. We won't keep you very long, but please do come and find me. We are open to any ideas, any contacts, any suggestions, constructive suggestions, please. So please do come and find me. Thank you very much.
No. I'm going to draw it to a close. I think Yeshin very sort of said a lot of very, very important things, but I want to say thank you all for coming this evening, and thank you so much to all the panelists. I think, this is terribly important that, these are voices from Cyprus that don't get heard enough. They don't get heard enough on the island, and they certainly don't get heard enough here.